This is In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle on News Talk 760 WJR, presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne and Rochelle Riley.
First Sunday of fall, Rochelle.
I'm so excited, and what a way to kick off the fall with the Pope coming to town.
Absolutely. Well, not to our town anyway, but to the
East Coast. American town.
Yeah, to the American town.
Yes.
I was just smitten. I saw a tweet that you sent out earlier in the week. The Pope, President Obama, this must have been at the White House, right?
Yes.
At the White House reception?
It was the official White House visit where he gave his remarks in English.
All right, so they were seated, but in front of them, there was a choir singing.
The St. Augustine Choir singing Total Praise. Oh, my God. Talk about chills.
And you said, tell us what the tweet said, because I thought it was delightful.
I just said, you know, there's the president, there's the Pope, there's this, you know, African-American choir, and I said, in my lifetime, Lord, I wish my grandparents were alive to see this.
Yeah, it was a very moving moment. The pageantry overall
was stunning.
You know, we've talked so much about this before. I'm Catholic, so naturally this has different meaning to me. But tell me about the impact that this visit has made for you.
Well, you know, at the risk of, you know, angering Catholics everywhere. I've never quite been comfortable with this idea of a man, you know, being treated with such revelry
and adulation.
And yes,
yeah.
It's like, you know,
Absolutely. Okay,
this is a guy, and you know, I grew up in the AME church, and you know, it's like, okay, there's God and there's Jesus, and so this idea that, but when you have someone who influences people in such a positive way, this particular Pope has given me a sense of what that means and what the papal, you know, tradition means, and so I got quite a schooling from this week.
Well, and you know, we consider that God's messenger on earth.
Absolutely.
So a message of love and peace that he is really spreading around the country.
It's great. So for these two men there together, I said, two agents of change. I get it. There's a messenger and there's a doer, and they are teaching people the right way to live.
Well, it's been quite a visit, and we'll have to bring in some of our friends to talk about it maybe in the weeks to come. But today we have Dr. Kara Kowalczyk and Dr. John Knapp. They happen to be married and both experts in female health.
You know, I bet they get along better than when I date journalists, you know.
All right, we'll see.
And you know, these are subjects that are sometimes uncomfortable for people to talk about. Women don't like to talk to men about the, you know, those types of things. I still refer to life as down there, which is kind of silly. But I love that we're going to have this open and honest discussion about some really important things.
We'll talk about it when we come back. Stay with us here on In the Mix on WJR.
The Mix with Marie and Rochelle, sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Now here's Marie Osborne.
Make sure you're thinking of her.
Beautiful Sunday afternoon, and Rochelle, let's go with the flow. If we're talking women's health, we got to talk about flow.
And I want to start with that and with leaking. I know that this is like, oh my God, did she just say
Sunday
that?
Afternoon,
you know,
we are talking about leaking.
Why not? Because I think that somehow we let product industry sort of dictate our health. Well, we know that pharmaceutical and product industries dictate our health. And so this idea of leaking, and particularly for women, you know, it's a little different for men who shake, but women who think that if they're leaking, that's something that's just a part of aging, that there's nothing you can do about it, that's just the way it is, and you go buy diapers, which is really sad. And I want to talk about that and whether that is true, whether that's a myth, that, you know, having the leaks is normal.
It's not normal. It's pretty common. There's about 10 million women in this country that do have urinary problems with leakage. 10 to 30% of all women have this issue, and it can be something as simple as a bladder infection that's been undiagnosed and untreated. It can be leakage of urine, stress urinary incontinence, when women cough, sneeze, jump on a trampoline, throw a bowling ball, they'll often leak urine. And there's things that can be done to prevent that from occurring and to fix it as well.
Well, I think that's a headline.
Yeah, but Dr. John, you know, I've always been told that, by the way, we're talking to Dr. Carol Kowalczyk today. Say hi, Dr. Carol.
Hi.
And Dr. John Knapp. Dr. John is an OBGYN. We're going to be talking all things women today, which is great. But Dr. John, I've always been told that the leaking thing is, you know, you had, you know, kids, that's a problem. It's your age, that's a problem. Can you just sign it off to things like that?
Those are all contributing factors. Some of it's hereditary. They have weakened collagen. childbirth destroys some of the pelvic anatomy. Weight gain is another issue. And sometimes it's the things that we consume. An overactive bladder is also common, where the muscle around the bladder contracts, and things like caffeine, alcohol, certain citrus can enhance that problem. So certain food avoidance and certain,
not lemons.
And not, well, lemons can do it.
Oh, too, my gosh.
That's in the citrus family.
Yeah.
So you got to try to avoid certain things and see if that works for you. But there's anatomic exercises, these Kegel exercises. You can ask your practitioner if you're doing them properly, and that can often prevent the pelvic floor from sagging. Your pelvis is like a hammock, and it stretches out as you sit on it through the summer, gain weight, have children come through this floor. And so the bladder tends to drop. And as that occurs, you tend to leak urine more and more. Kegel exercises are something that can be done that are helpful. There's minor surgical procedures that can be done. A midurethral sling is an outpatient procedure that takes 15 minutes to perform. What used to be done was a 2 to 3 hour procedure, a 3 day hospital stay, a large incision, and this minor procedure now is as good, if not better, than that old procedure that used to be performed on women.
Now, is it too late? Can it be too late to do something if you've let the pelvic floor sag for women who did not do anything all this time?
The best thing in any instance is prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So if you notice small symptoms, start your Kegel exercises where you it's as though you were holding something in the vagina or squeezing off your stool, and you hold that for a few seconds and relax. So when women, I tell them, when my patients are at stop signs, red lights, watching commercials, to do those Kegel exercises.
I'm doing it right now.
Good.
Let's talk a little bit about just the general health, down there, as I like to call it, and what women should do normally. I mean, I was asking Dr. Carroll about the idea of a PCP being your primary care physician, or having a primary care physician and a PCP, your primary care physician and a gynecologist. Instead of, one person doing everything, you have a specialist who, knows down there better. Is there a train of thought on which one works better?
I think many women have both a primary care physician to take care of their routine health problems and a gynecologist as well. It used to be that 60% of women would see their gynecologist as their primary care physician until they started developing problems or issues, high blood pressure, diabetes, and so forth, and then they'd be referred to an internist or a primary care physician. So to have both, I think, is ideal, and there are many primary docs that can take care of women's gynecologic problems, and when they become uncomfortable at a certain point with a certain problem or issue, they'll refer them to their favorite gynecologist.
Well, I'd love to know more about, Dr. John, the difference between a pap smear exam and a pelvic exam. I think there's some confusion about that. We'll talk about it when we come back here on In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Once again, here's Marie Osborne.
We are here with Dr. Carol Kowalczyk and Dr. John Knapp. And you know what, you two, by the end of this hour, I want to make sure we can get Rochelle to stop saying down there. All right.
That'll be our goal.
And you know what? If there are men listening, God bless you for listening today. We want to make sure that you stay in on this conversation. Right, everybody? I mean, this is a conversation for the not just the women, but for the men that are in their lives.
And absolutely.
Dr. John, you had mentioned earlier that sometimes there's this confusion between pap and pelvic exam. So why don't you lay it out for us?
So a pap smear is the sampling of the outside of the birth canal, and it's done on a regular basis to pick up problems before they get to cervical cancer. A pelvic is the examination of the vagina, the uterus, the ovaries, feeling these areas. Part of it's a rectal exam, examining lymph nodes, the urethra, the bladder, and so forth. The pap is a component of the pelvic exam, and there's been some recent changes in that they've tried to spread out pap smears. And some women have heard this and felt that they no longer need to get an annual pelvic exam because they're considering it as a pap smear. The American College of OB-GYN and some other societies have come together and they've recommended to spread out the pap smears starting at age 21 and then every 3 years or so. Now, you got to talk to your physician about this because certain people have certain other risk factors and should be continuing to get the paps on an annual or more frequent basis. But they're two different things. The American College of OB-GYN recommends an annual pelvic examination, not necessarily an annual pap smear. And it's hard because we work so hard to get people to come in on an annual basis that we've driven the incidence of cervical cancer through the floor. Now they're coming out with these other recommendations. I think some of it's to save money. And in this large monograph, they admit that there's going to be a doubling to tripling of the incidence of cervical cancer again. So the pendulum will swing one way and it'll swing back the other. Doubling or tripling something that's rare still makes it rare, and that's the thought behind spreading these out. But unfortunately, some lives will be affected.
At what age do you stop, or can you stop getting pelvics and or pap smears?
Some will say if you've had a hysterectomy and you've not, and it was for benign disease, so there wasn't cancer or significant precancerous changes, you can stop doing pap smears at age 65, or if there's a hysterectomy, you should get pelvic exams annually until basically you can't come and get them anymore. There's older women that have precancerous vulvar changes, lichen sclerosis. It's a whitishness to the outside of the vulva, and it often presents as chronic itching. It may be from urine exposure that we've talked about. And you can use ointments and creams that can prevent that from becoming a terrible vulvar cancer. So even in the elderly, you pick these things up.
And for our male listeners, the vulva is?
The vulva's down there.
Yeah.
So that's the outside of the vaginal area.
Exactly.
That's the skin that you can see.
Thank you, Dr.
Below.
John. Now, before we leave down there, I want us to talk a little bit about menopause and before that, having babies, because they're two different things.
Yeah, let's talk first about having the baby.
I know. I was going to say, let's reverse that and start with the having the babies. When are you, I mean, and literally, this is a question that every woman who may reach 40 and has not already had kids is freaking out about. When are you too old to have a baby? Does it have anything to do with age, or does it have to do with what's
physical
happening
fitness,
down there?
Yeah, or your physical, overall physical fitness?
My wife can speak to this, it becomes more difficult, even if everything's working perfectly well, after the age of 40. And as you age, your genetic risk for Down syndrome, some of the trisomies, the extra chromosomes, those gradually increase as you age. So, you know, it's never a perfect time to have a baby. My wife and I were young professionals. I think she was pregnant the first time at 34.
33.
We wanted to have four children, and we wanted to be done by 40, so we kind of rattled them off.
There was a Time article that said, oh, the best time to have a baby was in your early 20s. Well, who finds Mr. Amazing in their early 20s? So, you know, the average person who comes to see me for fertility is 36, 37, 38. And 35 is the new 28, 40 is the new 35. And what our challenge is when someone says, when's the best time to have a baby? My answer is, you know, when you feel ready and right, but also being very cognizant and knowledgeable about the fact that even though you're a 40 who's a young 35, your eggs have always been there. So unlike our guys who make sperm a new mix every 72 days, women have all the eggs they ever had in their life, and as they hit puberty, the millions of eggs they had when they were still in their mother's womb now goes to a 100,000 or so, and that's how they actually calculated menopause, is there's about 100 eggs every cycle that's trying to be the dominant egg, and as you get older, those eggs get older. So we usually say, you know, over 35 is going to be, you know, 6 months of trying is considered infertility. Over 40 is yesterday because of the quality of the eggs. And John talked about Down syndrome. We actually have, through a process called PGS or pre-implantation genetic sampling, we calculated the percentage of abnormal embryos a woman makes based on how old she is. So a 35-year-old, she's got a 50% chance of having an embryo who's abnormal. That's abnormal. Someone in their 40s has an 80 to 90% chance.
Wow.
So, you know, if you were 35 and you're thinking of having a family, you should probably get going. If you're 37 and have not found that person, you've got the choice to wait and know that your chances are going to be lower. You have the chance, option of freezing your eggs. We do that a lot now where couples are single and or women are single and haven't met that person. So we'll freeze their eggs and, you know, have them ready for when they need them. Or you can get, you know, have a baby on your own. We've got donor sperm that we've got plenty of that, you know, many women are like, you know what, I'm going to have my baby now and I'll wait for Mr. Amazing later and love me, love my child.
There is one other option. One of my dearest friends just had a baby via surrogate and mm-hmm. she and her husband welcomed that child by going to the hospital where the birth mother gave them their baby.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to ask one question, and anybody who says there are no dumb questions is wrong, because this one's going to be a little dumb. But, you know, women's eggs do diminish, do, you know, get small. Does anything happen to men's sperm over time?
Yes. When literature suggests that when men are in their late 40s, early 50s, there's more oxidative damage to the sperm, and therefore there is starting to be higher risks of birth defects when guys are older. With their sperm. And then again, they have more environmental exposures like high blood pressure, surgeries, infections, things like that.
They develop a new batch every so often. What is it, 40 to 60
every
days?
Every 72 days.
So the old batch may have a little something happening, but then they have a new batch.
And the older they get, they have more what we call reactive oxidative species in their what we call seminal fluid. So, and, you know, they start to have older sperm, which brings up potentially more genetic issues to their offspring.
Dr. Carroll, this is one area of medicine, I think, that unlike any other, really unlike any other, where societal pressures play on, you know, your medical, your health and your medical story, right? I mean, because a lot of women, I just know a lot of younger women in their 30s who feel this pressure to have kids, and what am I going to do, and how's it going to happen, and what if I can't, and just that adds the pressure on to them.
This is true. You could call it pressure, but what I call it in a more positive way is awareness. So prior to years ago, people kind of walked around like, oh, I'll have a baby when I'm ready to have a baby. And now there's so much focus through the TV personalities, Hollywood, us, that are making women aware. And while on the one hand you could think that's stress, on the other hand, it's awareness, it's knowledge, it's ownership. Saying, hey, you know, here's my fertility, what am I going to do about it? You know, and there are options out there depending on, you know, how creative they want to be.
Well, thank you so much. You're listening to In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle this Sunday afternoon, and we'll be right back.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health.
Our pleasure today to have Dr. Carol Kowalczyk and Dr. John Knapp in the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. And when you talk about busy power couples, these two are it. They happen to be married. They're both in the same field of women's health. And that brings us really to our next question. Dr. Carol, really, it's for you. When we talk about infertility, you talk about busy couples. You talk about couples that may want to start a family. I mean, you yourself lived right through this. You said you were, what, 32 or 33? You knew you wanted to have four kids and tick-tock. So how do couples come to those decisions? How do you play into that, helping them make those decisions or guiding them in those decisions?
What we do in Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health is when a couple comes to see me, one of my first questions is, what is your life plan? We used to just concentrate and focus on, let's get that first baby and let's get that, you know, Clomid in or the IVF, and then let's work on the first child. However, what we're focusing on now in fertility practices is, how many kids do you want in your life? And if someone comes to see me like they did yesterday, who's 36 and she wants three kids, let's go there. Let's do that math. The next month we're doing the workup. Then I give her Clomid and I get her pregnant. She delivers at 37, wants to breastfeed for a year. Now she comes back to me at 38 and wants baby number two. It takes me a little longer. So she gets pregnant at 39 for baby number two. Then she does the same 9 months gestation breastfeeding. Now she's over 40 with those statistics I gave you, Rochelle, the last segment. So in the life plan, a 35, 36-year-old who wants three kids, I may be talking about IVF to her because while it sounds aggressive, guess what? It is 3.5 times higher success rate, 15% success rate with Clomid, 50 to 60% with IVF. And guess what? I can make embryos, put one or two embryos in her uterus at 35, 36, but I've got three or four frozen for when she's ready. So she has her baby at 35. She comes back to me at 37, 38. Her embryo is still 35, 36. With the lower risk of birth defects with potentially the higher chance of success.
Let me ask you about Clomid, because I had a friend who was on Clomid many, many years ago, and I just wondered, that was sort of grueling for her, that whole process, and I wonder if the drug has changed or the regimen has changed, or tell us a little bit about that.
Clomid's been around since the 60s, so it is the FDA approved, and it's still very effective today. And when a woman gets Clomid, what we do in our practice differently than in John's practice, and he sees a lot of fertility patients as well at Eastside Gynecology, and that's where we do ultrasound monitoring. So the patient will get Clomid for a 5-day course in the beginning of their cycle, usually starting day 5. And then they'll do ultrasound monitoring for me to monitor and evaluate if they have a response. And the response is a cyst on the ovary, 18 to 20 millimeters. I'm hoping there's a good egg there. They get a trigger. That's a little more technical than what they did before, but it gives us more knowledge to see if it's working. Plus, we are in a shorter time span using that Clomid. So people back then would be on it for a year. Here,
exactly.
Now, it's 3 to 4 months. If you're not pregnant with it in 3 to 4 months, we're moving on to something else.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I just want to ask a couple of general questions about infertility. Is there any proof or are there any studies that show there are places where women are facing infertility more than other places? Are there environmental concerns? Is it all about stress and individual makeup down there?
They looked at environment. They looked at winter, summer. They looked at, you know, up by us in Michigan, down in Florida, no significant differences. Stress, when you talk about myths, it is a myth and it isn't. When you look at stress, everyone says, oh, I know so-and-so who stopped thinking about it, or they adopted and boom, they got pregnant. Could there be something to that? Potentially. On the one side of the coin, when you think about very stressful situations like depression, poverty, war, people are still getting pregnant. On the other hand, there's studies by Dr. Domar on the East Coast who has a support groups and found that couples who went to support groups individually or group sessions, there was a 30% potential increase in success with fertility treatments.
Wow.
There's no way to measure stress, and if you know, Mark says there's a fire out here, we're all going to be like, oh, we'll get out, but our stress level is going to be completely different. They're studying a potential blood test called alpha amylase to see if it could be a marker for stress, but that's early in investigation. So, you know, my advice to patients, why we have the Wellness Center and why it's important to my practice, is we do focus on the traditional medicine, but the complementary things like the acupuncture, massage, we have stress management coaches there, is that everything I think in conjunction with each other helps.
And I just can't imagine anything that's more anxiety-provoking than this. I mean, you want to have a baby, you're under pressure. Will it happen this month? Will it be okay? What will that in itself is stressful.
You're right. And in the literature, it is the third highest stress-provoking diagnosis, secondary to a cancer or HIV or AIDS diagnosis.
Wow.
And the difference
is
the first two, you don't feel very well. The third one, you're fine, and you're doing all the right things. My patients will stand on their head and spit quarters for an hour if it means that they're going to have a baby. And they're amazing, amazing couples. They will do whatever it takes. And God bless them, you know what I mean? And so it is very stressful.
How many of your patients are single women who do this on their own?
More and more. And I am getting a few a week that are coming to me. Many are professionals, teachers, doctors, lawyers, business people, and they are very aware that their fertility is starting to be a factor due to their age, and they're coming in for the egg freezing, or they're coming in to do it on their own with donor sperm, and they've got tremendous family support. I see women coming in with their mothers who say, you know what, I'm here for her when she has that baby. I'm going to help take care of that baby. And I see it's a beautiful thing that that option and that choice is available and open.
And when you talk about family, though, family can also be putting pressure on, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times parents, especially, not myself, of course, would be asking pointed questions in this area. And if you could talk to parents out there to say, you know, maybe butt out, right?
Well, in the show I do on Today's Woman, we do have had a section on that with our counselor, Claire, that the message to people helping family members go through infertility is not to be in their face, but more to say, I'm here for you. Can we talk about it? Do you want to talk about it? What can I do for you during this time? And know that you're going to be supportive to them. And a lot of times couples might be afraid to tell their parents because of the pressure of kids. But if the parents knew that it's very common, 10% to 15% of couples experience it, that, you know, be there for them and help guide them to the right direction of help, like John or myself, if they need it.
So. And that's one of the things you provide at the center, is that you have counselors there to help with these very questions, right?
Mm-hmm. That's got to be a huge part of this, making sure that there's counseling and support as they go through this, right?
It's recommended that every fertility couple goes through a counseling session. So it's not like a, you know, state your name, I'm on the couch weekly kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It is a powerful visit to a counselor for fertility, and we have two on staff, and most fertility specialists have that, is to just talk about it and get it out there. You know, what are your fears? What are your hopes? What are your dreams? How many kids? Where are you at? And it helps me in the process of helping the right treatment plan happen.
Well, I can tell you, as someone who spent years searching for Mr. We Can Make It Work instead of Mr. Right, I decided to adopt.
Oh, God bless you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
But I do wonder about what life is like for women who sort of go through that whole time span and they don't do it. And you know, is there an afterburner sort of effect? Like, if you wind up not, like, what happens with your patients who you're not successful? And I mean, do you, sorry, we couldn't make it work, bye. And
well, that's a very, very important question, because the journey is unknown. I will do whatever I can to help you get pregnant, but you're right. There are those couples that through everything have not been successful, and we talk about it, go through that journey, and that's where our counselors are important, to be able to say to them that they still have a beautiful life and they can have other choices, like adopting or like being an amazing couple, like fostering kids, like being with nieces and nephews.
Absolutely.
And so that's where our counselor comes in.
We're talking with Dr. Carol Kowalczyk, an expert, our resident expert on infertility, and Dr. John Knapp, an OBGYN extraordinaire. And when we come back, we're going to ask about a new treatment for menopause.
Baby, I'm yours.
Well, we've left mammograms and menopause for the last segment for our show, and vitally important topics that, I mean, Rochelle and I talk about these items all the time, in fact, and we're glad that Dr. John Knapp is here today to join us to talk a little bit about this. Dr. John, what can you tell us a little bit about menopause? And obviously a larger portion of the population is now going through menopause than ever before. So clearly this is a big topic. What's the big thing that women come to into your office either concerned about or complaining, if you will, about menopause?
Well, menopause, first of all, is the occurs on an average of 50 to 52, and it's basically running out of eggs which have produced estrogen over the years that help stimulate the lining and cause a menstrual flow. And it's that lack of estrogen that causes a variety of symptoms. Hot flashes are the big ones that people wake up at night. They get poor sleep, they can't concentrate the next day. Eventually can cause vaginal dryness, irritability, mood swings, urinary incontinence because you don't have that nice plush urethra. And those are the main symptoms that people come in complaining of.
But I know that they don't treat this anymore with, I can't think of the name of the...
Estrogen.
They don't treat it with estrogen anymore. So what other treatments are out there for these... I'm sorry, some of these symptoms, I know women that are completely debilitated by some of these symptoms.
So estrogen still is an option, but you should talk to your practitioner about using it. It's been well studied, and the Women's Health Initiative that finished in 2002-2004 showed an increased risk of breast cancer with some of these, increased risk of heart disease with some of these. But for some, it's a wonderful thing, and it's the only thing that seems to help. Other options are herbals. There's loads of them. I often recommend...
Do they work?
They have mixed effectiveness, and some work well for some women and not at all for others. Black cohosh is an herb that doesn't contain estrogen. I'll often, in people that are concerned about estrogens, I'll have them start on that often, and it's 60 to 80 milligrams. They can move up to 200 milligrams in 20 milligram increments every few weeks till they get symptom relief. That works great for some people. There's evening primrose, there's flaxseed oil, St. John's wort, DHEA, Dong Quai, soy. Women will take soy and soy-like products, which have some estrogen-like properties, and they think they're avoiding those inherent risks of estrogen, and in fact, ignorance is bliss, and they are getting and consuming estrogen through
in
those.
In basic soy?
Yes. Yep.
So like if you drink soy milk or you're getting
soy
estrogen?
Soy nuts, tofu, you're getting some degree of estrogen.
So and are you and other doctors still prescribing estrogen?
In some instances, yes. Most of the time I recommend people just try and go through menopause and see how they do. 20% of women do not get symptoms in the menopause. And if that's the case, or they can tolerate those symptoms, they gradually will often subside. And if they do, wonderful. They don't need anything. Those women who don't do well on the herbals can be given certain off-label medicines. There's an Effexor. It's used to treat depression. But in smaller doses, it seems to work well in some women for hot flashes. There's another FDA-approved medicine that's out recently, paroxetine. It's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. What that means is it changes the serotonin amount in your brain, and that can give symptom relief. It's used to treat depression as well.
How long is a typical menopause?
The transition is highly variable. Some don't go through it. Some it's a year. Some it's two. Some 10 years after they started, they still come
ten
in every
years?
Year.
10 years well, with symptoms, huh?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
dang Eve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have bit that apple.
Oh, my God.
Now, vaginal dryness, too, is something that people in the menopause complain of. And one of the things is lubrication is very, very helpful. Estrogen intravaginally can help. Also, you know, we developed an organic lubricant called Sensual, and John uses it. I use it because it's sperm friendly, but John uses it a lot for his patients because it helps make sex a lot less uncomfortable. And honey, isn't that right? You keep telling me use it or lose it when it comes to menopause and vaginal dryness. So
well,
is that true?
It is true to some extent. People, the vagina will atrophy and slowly close down if it's...
Holy crap.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Sunday.
Really? Yeah.
So use it
when I do this.
There's some pollen extracts that have come out that are non-prescription over-the-counter that seem to reduce hot flashes by up to 60%. So that's a newer thing that's out.
Well, now that we've scared the heck out of every woman approaching 50, and most of the men who would date them, I want to go back to this sensual cream. Mm-hmm. Now, what is this that you're talking about? That's
you
something,
developed this, doctor?
It is a Michigan-based development. So we have
Michigan.
Yay! So we have an organic skincare line and organic makeup. And the reason it was developed was initially because of fertility patients said, we women... You tell us to eat right, you tell us to work out, and what we put in our bodies nutritionally can potentially affect fertility. But a woman will put more than 100 chemicals on her body every day between her moisturizers, her
That's
conditioner,
exactly
her shampoo,
right.
and all that. So I'm driving home, and I'm like, okay, I better figure something out. So we went through Michigan-based companies, organic companies, and found a female-owned, Michigan-based, and we worked together in developing the skincare line and then the vaginal lubricant. So it's all organic, and so it doesn't cause... irritation, and it's very, very, very effective, and it's a combination of olive oils and coconut oils and things like that. And it's something that we tested for sperm viability and found that on head-to-head with the competitors out there, people need to know that you go to CVS or Rite Aid or whatever, you get Astroglide or you get, you know, some of these, they kill sperm. So there's very few lubricants out there that
sounds like a skateboard material.
That do not kill sperm. But on the other end of the spectrum, women who have no estrogen or low estrogen, people just had a baby, people who just had surgery, had their ovaries, you know, removed, menopause, you know, they tolerate it, you know, very well. So for the men out there, get some sensual and tell your wife, use it or lose it.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's, so Rochelle and I are
I'm
now
speechless.
Yeah,
I know.
Show over. Okay.
All right.
Think about that one.
Okay, you know what? We're just going to move from down there to up here. I can talk about boobies. This is very important for a lot of women. And as a woman who has this false, you know, thing to happen all the time, you know, fibrous breasts, mm-hmm. where, you know, there's always a little something and they want to aspirate and make sure it's nothing. Let's talk about mammograms. How often, what should frighten you, what should not frighten you?
Mammograms are screening tests that can pick up breast cancer early and save a lot of lives. And the American College of OB-GYN recommends that they be performed annually and continue annually until they can't have them performed or become sickly. There are certain women who have very dense breast, and now there's a new 3D ultrasound that's available. So if you have a report on a previous mammogram that showed very dense breast, it improves the sensitivity about 30%. So, you know, you should also do your breast exams. There were some studies that poo-pooed that, but I've had many, many women come in detecting their own breast cancer
Absolutely.
Early.
Mm-hmm.
And mammograms, as wonderful as they are, don't pick up about 7 to 13% of breast cancers. So between the two of those, you should
got the
pick up.
Covered, right?
Right. And people fear radiation exposure. The amount of radiation in a mammogram is a one-way flight to Arizona. So it's a very small amount of radiation.
What you talking about, Willis? What do you mean radiation on a flight to Arizona?
Well, you're exposed to radiation flying an airplane.
Rochelle is like going to need to take a pill by the end of the show.
You know what? I wasn't having coffee, but I'm going to have some.
So that radiation is the equivalent to a mammogram. It's pretty nominal.
You get radiation all the time. I mean, through environment, right?
Well, you know, like toaster, microwave. I didn't know it. You know how much I fly?
Yeah, being up at the top of this building probably exposes
me. I'm leaving right now.
There you go. Well, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so we absolutely wanted to do the pitch here for breast cancer awareness. And you want to, they're taking home messages, continue with the self exams and get the yearly, right, doctor?
And get your annual exam by a practitioner who also examines your breasts, and do your own monthly breast exams.
It's important.
But know how to do them.
Okay, so you've heard it here on Sunday afternoon, everything that you need to know about using it or losing it, taking care of yourself, and watching out for women's vaginas.
Yay, you said it!
There you go.
Yay.
We have evolved. Dr. Carol Kowalczyk, thank you so much for joining us today.
And Dr. John Knapp.
Dr. John Knapp, thank you very much for joining us. Our producer today, Dr. Laura Hessen. Our producer today, Laura Hessen, Mark Blackwell.
Dr. Mark Blackwell.
Yeah.
Let everybody get their degree.
Our technology here, we really appreciate it. Thanks so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
You were awesome.
Thank you, guys.
We appreciate it. See you next week on In the Mix.